Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's good morning, boys and girls. My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it is my pleasure to welcome you here on this last day of Einstein Fest. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I see an awful lot of familiar faces of people who've been coming over the course of the entire festival. This morning we have a real treat for you as we wrap up Legacy Weekend with three fantastic speakers who will be speaking about Einstein and his legacy. This morning we will start off with an old friend, Professor John Stachel, who's Emeritus Professor of Physics and Director at Boston University and Director of the Center for Einstein Studies at Boston University. He received his PhD in General Relativity from Stevens Institute of Technology before taking up positions at Lehigh University, Pittsburgh University, and then moving on to Boston University. John is one of the world's foremost Einstein scholars. Many of you may recall that we've had him here before at a Perimeter Institute event. He participated so well with Lee Smolin and John Moffitt in our public event in May on Einstein and his legacy, and we are delighted to welcome him back today to speak once again. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor John Stachel.
Thank you so much for a kind introduction. It's always a pleasure to come back to Perimeter. When you're at Perimeter, you're not at the Perimeter, you're at the center. Now, I hope everybody read the abstract of my talk, because you see the other Einstein, maybe somebody thinks I'm going to talk about Einstein's secret love life, or his participation in some occult rites. This is far from the case. We're still at the intellectual level, but I hope it will be an exciting other side of Einstein that's not too well known that I'll present to you today. I'll start out with young Einstein. I guess one of the hardest problems is to get people to remember that Einstein was also young once, just like everybody else. Here he is as a young lad. And he got his first real introduction to science when a medical student, about 10 years older than he, was taken in by the family once a week to give him dinner. This medical student, Max Talmai, realized Einstein was a rather precocious child, and he started to give him popular scientific books, mathematics books, philosophy books. He said Einstein soon outstripped him in mathematics and philosophy. But the most important thing he did was introduce him to the best German popular scientific literature. And one of the books that they gave to Einstein, and that Einstein remembered reading, was Humboldt's Cosmos. Alexander Humboldt was a very famous figure in the history of German natural science and in German intellectual life generally. But the thing that concerns us here is this book, Cosmos, which you see has actually been translated into English. It's a sketch of the physical description of the universe. It was an attempt to sum up all that was known about the universe at the time it was written in the early 19th century. And in keeping with the 19th century German philosophical tradition, Humboldt stressed the idea of the unity of all natural phenomena. Perhaps some of you have heard of German Naturphilosophie, which was sort of a semi-mystical extension of these ideas, which had a lot of influence on science. For example, Ørsted, the physicist, was very much influenced by that in his studies of electricity, so important for the history of that field. But Einstein soon adopted Humboldt's point of view about the unity of all natural phenomena. And Peter Bowler, in a recent article, has summarized very nicely Humboldt's approach. For Humboldt, humanity's perception of nature's unity and power was as much aesthetic as it was rational. And I think that's as true for Einstein as it was for Humboldt. When Einstein said, "I want to know how God made the universe," for example, God for him symbolized rationality, perfection. The universe couldn't have been constructed in an ugly, unaesthetic way. And as Bowler says, this is a vision far more in tune with Romanticism than with the dry natural theology of Darwin's mentors. And there was a romantic streak in Einstein, which I have written about and talked about on another occasion, but that's not what I'm going to emphasize today. Well, I'll give you two quotes from Einstein to show how important this feeling was for him. At the very beginning of his career, at the time he had just written his first paper, he wrote to a friend, because this paper on capillarity tried to bring together a number of phenomena under one heading, one explanation. And he says, it's a wonderful feeling to realize the unity of a complex of phenomena, which to immediate sensory perception appear to be totally separate things. By the way, a little housekeeping note. When I put something in red, it's my emphasis. If it's in italics or quotes, it's the author's emphasis. So red here is my emphasis. And in 1932, in summing up his achievements for that day, he said, the real goal of my research has always been the simplification and unification of the system of theoretical physics. So this was a lifelong feeling, goal he had, and he was quite aware of this. When Einstein was growing up, and here he is as a rather cocky-looking young student at the Swiss Federal Polytechnic in Zurich, the hottest topic in theoretical physics at that time was Maxwell's theory. And he was very upset that it was not being taught the particular year he was there. It had been taught the year before, actually, but the person who taught it left. But the year that Einstein was there was not taught, and he had to study it on his own. But what did Maxwell's theory do? From the point that concerns us most here, it was a unification of these very disparate phenomena, electricity, magnetism, and optics. What do these things have to do with each other? Well, at the phenomenal level, very little or nothing. But of course, what Maxwell did was to show that they could be unified theoretically by the introduction of the concept of the electromagnetic field. And indeed, Einstein advanced that unification in his own work on special relativity, but again, I won't go into that today. So from 1909, remember 1905 was his Annus Mirabilis, the year in which he propounded the special theory of relativity and his ideas about quantum phenomena, quantum nature of light. From that time on until the end of his life, he was constantly proposing various field theories to extend the kind of unification of which Maxwell's theory presented him with sort of the ideal model, the one which he grew up with. First, he attempted to unify matter and radiation within the special theory of relativity. That was the work of 1909. Maxwell just took matter as something which acted as a source of radiation. He had no explanation for it. So matter is given, and the electromagnetic field, the radiation field, is explained by the influence of matter on the ether, in Maxwell's version. Einstein was trying to find some way of unifying matter and radiation, find some unified explanation of both. And indeed, that was always part of the goal, even his later work. Then after he developed the general theory of relativity in 1915, well, the search for it ended in 1915, end of 1915, beginning of 1916, he searched for unification of gravitation and electromagnetism, the only two forces that were known at that time. He wanted to do this as an extension of general relativity, extend the general theory of relativity to what he called a unified theory. And that was a goal on which he worked to the end of his life, never entirely to his own satisfaction, as we shall see, nor certainly to the satisfaction of the physics community. Well, I've used the word field theory. What is a field theory? All field theories involve some functions of spatial and temporal coordinates. We'll go into function and so forth in a little more details, but let me just be preliminary here. What kind of functions depends on what physical phenomena the theory is meant to explain. If it's electromagnetic theory, for example, the functions will be electric and magnetic fields. If it's gravitational theory, it'll be, well, inertial gravitational field, different kind of functions. Consequently, but they're always functions of spatial and temporal coordinates. So all field theories depend on some concept of space and time. And these space and time are assumed to form a continuum, and we'll go into what that means in a moment. And the functions are assumed to be smooth functions of the space and time coordinates, that is, continuous and differentiable functions. And now we'll go into a little bit more detail. This sort of primer for review for those who are familiar with these ideas and brief introduction for those who are not. I've talked about variable, something variable. Well, what's a variable? A variable is any quantity that varies, any attribute, phenomena, or event that can have different values. Simple examples. The speed of the car that brought you here, or your speed if you walked, your weight, unfortunately variable, tends to be increasing variable with time. The number of people in this room, of course, is variable. Some of them may leave in the middle of my talk, their number may go down. Someone come late, their number will go up. The length of time I've been talking, you may wish that variable has an upper limit. The number of grains of sand that reach the bottom of an hourglass. Somebody might be timing my talk with an hourglass, and you could count the number of grains of sand. Those would also be a variable. Well, there are two main types of variables, continuous and discrete. Some examples. The number of people in this room is the discrete variable. We do not look kindly on cutting people up. So they're units. There's either 37 or 38 people in this room. 37 and a half just will not do. But the total weight of these people is a continuous variable. Somebody might be munching a candy bar as I speak, and the weight would go up. So we assume that's a continuous variable of the time, of course. Now, a function is an association between an independent and a dependent variable. And I'll give some examples of that in a moment. But when I talk about a function, I mean here is an independent variable x, and here's a variable y which depends on it, or is a function of it, as we say. Now, I'll give you a simple example with a very complex morrow, as you'll see. The temperature is a dependent variable here. It's certainly a continuous function, but we're going to examine that in a moment, of the place on the Earth, so that would be the independent spatial variables, and the time, independent temporal variables. If you took a thermometer and placed it at different places on the Earth, you could get different temperatures, and as time went on, the temperatures would change. But now, you were asking, how do you know that temperature really is continuous, or how continuous it is? And how do we know whether space and time are really continuous? Well, you have to understand this takes place within a theoretical context. That question has no meaning aside from some theory about temperature and space and time. So what we do is we build theories assuming that they are continuous, and then accept and use the theories until some failure of the theory to pass some test tells us that we must re-examine our assumptions. So we can start out by assuming something to be continuous, build up a theory on that basis, and if the theory works, then our assumption is justified to the extent that the assumption works. When the assumption breaks down or appears to break down, we must re-examine it and see whether it's just an apparent failure or we really have to modify our ideas. So the point is that you need to have some theoretical context and ask the question, is this variable continuous or discrete? Outside of simple cases, of course, like the number of people in this room. Even so, if I said the number of molecules in people's bodies in this room, you might wonder, is that a discrete variable or a continuous variable? It turns out it's continuous. It's a discrete variable. For many, many purposes, you can treat it as discrete. And I'll give some examples of that in a moment. In fact, right now. For example, consider the sand flowing out of a pail. I had an hourglass a moment ago. I'll consider it as a pail because I want to fill the pail with water in a moment. The sand flowing out of the pail can be treated as continuous flow for many purposes. But you know, and easily recognize, it's actually composed of discrete grains of sand. So you could write the amount of sand in the pail as a continuous function of the time, but you know if you really look a little bit more closely, you'd have to admit it really is not a continuous function, it's a discrete function, but the steps are so slight as time goes on that you can approximate it very well by continuous curve. So you see the answer to the question, discrete or continuous, may depend on how closely you look. Water flowing out of that same pail, we've emptied the sand, let's fill it with water, that now can be treated as a continuous flow for all everyday purposes. No experiment you will ever do with everyday means will ever detect the fact that the water is not continuous. But we know, after centuries of research by physics and chemistry, that it's actually composed of discrete molecules of H2O. That's, of course, a remarkable scientific achievement, which you never see directly, but you have good and sufficient theoretical reasons to accept that answer. So again, whether something is treated discrete or continuous may depend on how closely you look and how far your theories have advanced. Well, there are some delicate problems here. For example, it's often said that energy is quantized. And that's quite true, given a frequency nu. We write E equals H nu. I neglected to write that formula down. H being Planck's constant, and therefore energy is quantized in units of H nu. You can have 1 H nu, 2 H nu, 3 H nu, but never half of an H nu. But as far as we know today, frequency, this frequency nu that I've written, is not quantized. Any frequency could occur in some situation. But let's look a little bit more closely at this question. We treat the frequency as continuous in all of our theoretical calculations, but the speed, the wavelength, and frequency of a wave are related by the equation the speed is equal to the product of the wavelength times the frequency. Now, if you put in the dimension of the speed, it's length divided by time. The dimension of wavelength, as the name suggests, is length. The dimension of frequency is time to the minus first power, number of vibrations per second, right? So 1 over time. So you see from that formula, if space and time were quantized, then so would be wavelength and frequency, and our answer would have to be changed. So the fact that we treat frequency as a continuous variable depends on a previous assumption that space and time variables are continuous, an assumption which we will come back to later on. But I just want to indicate how delicate the answer to the question discrete or continuous can be. Well, how could we find out if space and time are discrete? Well, I'll just I'm not saying this is the best way, but just to give you one direct way you might test this. Indeed, it has been done. As I said before, if you make the contrary assumption, assume they are continuous, calculate the probable outcomes of interactions between particles taking place over smaller and smaller regions of space and smaller intervals of time. That means in practice, you make the particles clash at higher and higher energies, so the interaction takes place over a smaller and smaller region of space and in a shorter and shorter interval of time. And you see whether the calculations that you predicted for the probabilities agree with your observations. You do experiments on elementary particles, and you calculate cross-sections, and you see whether those calculations come out. And those experiments have been done. Indeed, at one time, people as eminent as Bohr and Pauli thought it could well be the case that our experiments would show us a divergence between a theoretical prediction and the actual result, and that this divergence could be due to the discrete nature of space and time. But so far, all high-energy experiments that have been performed are consistent with this continuity hypothesis, that space and time are continuous. But as we shall see later, these experiments are still very, 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 and I could put in about 37 varies, far from reaching the regions of space and the intervals of time where we have reason to suspect that continuity could break down. So all I can say is, so far there is no evidence. That by no means means that there won't be evidence later on. And later in this talk, I'll give some arguments to suggest that we have reason to believe there will be such evidence turning up, but a long, long way from the energies we have reached today. Well, after that little excursion, background concepts, let's go back to field theory. So in field theories, space and time are treated as continuous, independent variables. And I hope by now everybody knows what those, that's at least an idea what I mean by continuous, independent, and variable. And the functions which describe the field are treated as continuous, dependent variables. But everything is continuous and even differentiable. So I'll talk about continuous Einstein now. Because of his lifelong work on field theories, Einstein is usually regarded, and even taken as the bête noir, as the advocate of par excellence of the effort to solve all problems of physics based on the space-time continuum, this continuous theories. Any discreteness in physics, if you take that point of view, would have to come from one of two possible sources. Particles moving in the continuum, we treat particles as point particles, at least classically, and this leads to an uncomfortable field-particle dualism, a point which I'll return to later. If you say that, well, there are fields on the one hand, which are continuous, and particles which are discrete entities in this continuous space-time, why are these two things so different? Do we really need these two things? Well, say to present-day physics, we seem to, at least at the classical level, the quantum field theory comes a long way towards reconciling these two, but I won't go into that point. But at least that dualism was not something that Einstein would want to accept. He would say either should be fields or should be particles. He wanted a monism, in other words, not a dualism, or one way or the other. The other possibility to get discreteness is that you could have conditions that restrict the solutions of the continuous field equations to a discrete set. That the equations are continuous doesn't mean that the solutions have to be continuous. There might be certain variables in the, parameters in the theory for which the solution only existed with certain values of these parameters, and that could introduce discreteness. And you could think of several ways in which this could happen, three of them in the main. One of them was what Einstein called overdetermination of the field equations. Suppose there are more equations than there are independent variables. Well, then it could be that there are no solutions, or if you fine-tune things just right, it might be that there are solutions only for certain discrete values of the parameters. That's one possibility that Einstein considered early on. The other possibility, to which he attached more importance later in his life, you could demand the solutions to the equation, to the nonlinear equations, be singularity-free. Nonlinear equations have very few solutions to begin with. It's very hard to find solutions to them. And if you demand they be singularity-free, it was always Einstein's hope that this would restrict the solutions to certain discrete values of the parameters. So these are the two possibilities that Einstein had long advocated. Indeed, he advocated the second possibility, the search for singularity-free solutions to his unified field theory equations to the end of his life. But of course, mathematicians couldn't find the solution, so the problem was left open, and most people have abandoned hope in the whole project. Curiously enough, he never seems to have taken seriously the third one, which was actually used in quantum mechanics. So I just mentioned this. Standing waves in a string gives you an example of this. The third way is boundary conditions. Suppose you clamp the two ends of a string and you try to set up a standing wave in it. In other words, where the vibration just goes up and down, it doesn't progress from side to side. If you attempt to set up such a standing wave pattern with the ends clamped, you'll find there are only certain distinct vibration frequencies at which this can happen. And that vibration frequencies depend on the length of the string between the two ends and the tension in the string. Well, essentially, this is a watered-down version of what quantum mechanics does. We take the wave equation, the Schrodinger wave equation, we look for solutions with certain boundary conditions. For example, the wave should vanish rapidly enough at infinity, and that restricts the solution to certain frequencies. E equals h nu, that means you have only certain energies possible, so you get discreteness out of boundary conditions. But Einstein never seems to have seriously considered that possibility, curiously enough. So far, what I've said about Einstein, now we're getting to the other Einstein. So far, what I've said about Einstein is well known. As I say, it's always well known to those who know it well. But there is another Einstein who had long been skeptical about the adequacy of the space-time continuum. He questioned this continuum idea on which all of his ideas about field theory were built. We said you can't have a field theory without continuum of space-time. And yet, although Einstein worked on this all his life, there was another side of him who would say, whoa, maybe this is the root of all our problems. And it was, of course, the existence of quantum phenomena which suggested to him that maybe the continuum is just too rich, has too much structure in it, and the quantum phenomena telling us we have to use something much more discrete. Well, I've written an article about this that I called The Other Einstein, Einstein Contra Field Theory, published first in a magazine and now it's republished in a book. If you think this is a book plug, you're absolutely right. But as early as 1916, Einstein wrote to Walter Dallenbach, who had been a student of his. By this time, Einstein is in Berlin. Dallenbach has remained in Switzerland studying at the Poly, where Einstein had been a student and later a teacher. And he wrote to Dallenbach about his thesis topic, and Dallenbach's thesis topic, and they got into general discussion. And Einstein said this, as early as 1916, remember, this is just at the height of his triumph with field theory. General relativity has just reached its final formulation after about 8 years of work by him. You have correctly grasped the drawback that the continuum brings. If the molecular view of matter is correct, the appropriate one, that matter is composed of molecules. Molecules here means atoms, electrons, particles, molecularly used very loosely. If this is correct, that is, if a part of the universe is to be represented by a finite number of moving points, then the continuum of the present theory contains too great a manifold of possibilities. Einstein's words for what I was trying to say a moment ago. I also believe that this too great is responsible for the fact that our present means of description miscarry with the quantum theory. Continuing, the problem seems to me to be how one can formulate statements about a discontinuum without calling upon a continuum. Space-time is an age. You see, a moment ago we saw how you could get statements about a discontinuum, namely quantized frequencies, out of a continuum by boundary conditions, by overdetermination, by singularity. But Einstein says, no, the problem is if you're really going to give up the continuum, you have to see how you can get statements about a discontinuum without calling upon a continuum, get rid of continuous space-time. The latter should be banned from the theory as a supplementary construction, something you construct later on out of whatever discrete entities you finally seize upon, and you have to then reconstruct space-time as some sort of approximation, just the same as you can construct a continuous liquid out of the molecules by taking so many of them per unit volume that it appears as if the liquid is continuous. So the latter should be banned from the theory, namely the continuum, space-time, as a supplementary construction not justified by the essence of the problem, which corresponds to nothing real, and that's Einstein's quote now. But we still lack the mathematical structure, unfortunately. How much have I already plagued myself in this way? This is written in 1916, right? And he says, oh, at that time, how much have I already plagued myself in this way? And now I'm going to speculate on what he means by that. What had he been thinking about earlier that led him to say how much he's already plagued himself with this? Well, now I present to you the Academy Olympia. When Einstein was first moved to Bern to work in the Swiss Patent Office, he first tried to get some students to tutor in physics as a sort of means of supplementing his income, but very soon he gave up interest in that. The two young men he met were so interesting, they decided to meet regularly to discuss problems in science, philosophy of science, art, literature, what have you, and they formed this mock academy, the Academy Olympia. None of them could have been shown into the sacred confines of any real academy, so they made up their own Academy Olympia, sort of mock the idea of the real academies. And there they are, well, Einstein, I suppose you recognize, Maurice Salavina and Konrad Habich. And they discussed many, many books, and Maurice Salavina, luckily enough, in later life, wrote a, well, he published all of Einstein's letters to him, and he wrote a memoir about his contacts with Einstein and about the Academy of Olympia, so we have a pretty good idea of what they read. And if we look at their readings, we can figure out perhaps what he meant by how long I've plagued myself. Some of the readings give us a good idea. First of all, we know they read Richard Dedekind, the famous mathematician who wrote a book, Was sind und was sollen die Zahlen? What are numbers and what should they be? And in the course of this book, Dedekind points out that you don't need a continuum to develop ideas about geometry. There's a quote from this book that Einstein read. For a great part of the science of space, the continuity of its configuration is not even a necessary condition. Then he gives an example based on the concept of algebraic numbers. I won't go into the details, it's not important for our purpose, except the word algebraic, because Einstein later on talked about a purely algebraic physics, and he may have gotten that word algebraic from Dedekind. But the end result of this example is the space is made up of points of M. Space made up of the points of M is everywhere discontinuous. But in spite of this continuity, all constructions of Euclid's elements, Euclidean geometry, in other words, can be just as accurately affected as in perfectly continuous space. The discontinuity of this space would not be noticed in misprint in Euclid's science, would not be felt at all. Well, that may well have struck Einstein. In other words, if you do all your measurements in Euclidean geometry, that does not prove space is continuous, because Dedekind has given an example of a discontinuum, which gives you all the results of Euclidean geometry. Counterintuitive, but true. I maintain Einstein was struck by this. Another reading was David Hume, famous philosopher, 18th century philosopher. His treatise on human nature was also studied in the Academy of Olympia, and Einstein himself later on says he was influenced in reminiscing about the origins of special relativity and general relativity. He says he was influenced by Hume's ideas about space and time. But I won't talk about those ideas of Hume, but about the ideas that relate to this concept of continuum versus discontinuum. So this is from a section of the book called Of the Ideas of Space and Time. The book is from 1739, by the way. The capacity of the mind is not infinite. Consequently, no idea of extension, space, or duration, time, consists of an infinite number of parts or inferior ideas, but of a finite number, and these are simple and indivisible. It is therefore possible for space and time to exist conformable to this idea, that is, to be composed of parts that are simple and indivisible, not points of a continuum, but discrete entities. And if it be possible, it is certain they are actually conformable. They actually are conformable to it. Now, that's a rather strong statement. I'm not saying that Einstein necessarily bought that, because it's conceivable, it must be the truth. But at least Hume is raising the question. Since their infinite divisibility, that is, infinite divisibility of space and time, is utterly impossible and contradictory. Well, again, I'm not saying that Einstein bought that, but Hume, you see, is raising the question very clearly. Why do we believe that space and time are infinitely divisible? These indivisible parts, being nothing in themselves, are not conceivable when not filled with something real and existent. And this last part Einstein certainly did buy. The ideas of space and time are therefore no separable or distinct ideas, but merely those of the order or manner in which objects exist. In other words, space and time are not a container into which you pour matter, the absolute concept of space and time, but space and time are relational properties of the various parts of matter, the content of matter. That idea Einstein certainly bought, as we'll see, one of the main lessons he drew from the general theory of relativity. Another reading of the Academy of Olympia was Bernard Riemann's On the Hypothesis Forming the Basis of Geometry. This, again, played a great role in Einstein's later life. This was the foundation of the concept of Riemannian geometry, not the constant curvature Riemannian geometry, but the variable curvature Riemannian geometry, which was so important, so crucial for the development of the general theory of relativity. But Riemann has some other comments about this question of continuous versus discrete manifolds, which again must have struck Einstein if he was plaguing himself for such a long time about this question. The question of the validity of the postulates of geometry in the indefinitely small is involved in the question concerning the ultimate basis of relations of size in space. Riemann only talks about space here, not time. While in a discrete manifold, the principle of metric relations is implicit in the concept of the manifold, it must come from somewhere else in the case of a continuous manifold. I point out here for those who know mathematics that Riemann is not using the word manifold in the modern sense, where manifold implies continuity. He's using manifold in a more loose sense here, where a manifold could be discrete or continuous. We might say set here or something like that. Either then, the actual things forming the foundations of space must constitute a discrete manifold, or else the basis of metric relations must be sought for outside that actuality in colligating forces that operate on it. And if you change that from space to space-time, you get a pretty good idea of the program that Einstein had in mind. But what I'm emphasizing here is the other aspect. Riemann says there are two possibilities, a manifold of space, in his case, space-time for Einstein, could be either discrete or continuous. Both are possible. Now I'm going back to that 1916 letter. This excursion was saying what he could have meant by how long I plagued myself, trying to get some idea of the readings that could have led him to think about these questions from early on. So now Einstein is discussing the other side of the particle field dualism. Remember I said for Einstein dualism was not a tenable alternative. If there's problems with field theory, maybe you should get rid of fields and just have particles. And Einstein discussed that possibility. Yet I see difficulties of principle here too. The electrons as points would be the ultimate entities in such a system, building blocks. Are there indeed such building blocks? Now that are there is his emphasis, not mine. Are there indeed such building blocks? Why are they all of equal magnitude? Why is every electron like every other electron? Is it satisfactory to say God in his wisdom made them as all equally big? And remember, God is, for Einstein, not an anthropomorphic God, but it's a symbol for the rationality of the universe, the rational structure of the universe. So why is the universe constructed in such a way that all the particles are exactly the same? If it had pleased him, could he have also created them different? Further, the old question of the vacuum. Well, if everything is particles, what does it mean when no particles are present? That's the question of the vacuum. It's a big problem for a pure particle point of view. But he still said the weight still falls on the other side. But these considerations must pale before the overwhelming fact the continuum is more ample than the things to be described. So in this 1916 letter he's saying to Dallenbach, it still seems like the field theories based on the continuum have more problems than the pure particle theory would have. Well, some of my quotes got into smaller size. I'm sorry, but I hope you can read them. In 1923, he first discussed this issue publicly when he started to discuss these questions of different types of unified field theories. But before he launches on his unified field theory attempts, he discusses the question of whether it's even feasible. The essential element of the previous theoretical development, he means all the rest of theoretical physics up to 1923, Maxwell's theory, his special theory of relativity, general theory of relativity. The essential element of the previous theoretical development lies in the circumstance that they work with differential equations in a four-dimensional spatial-temporal continuum, the continuum idea. In view of the existing difficulties, one has despaired of the possibility of describing the actual processes by means of differential equations. He obviously means himself. He's the one who's despaired. Even beyond that, the possibility of a complete extension of the law of causality on the basis of the four-dimensional space-time continuum has been doubted. By the way, this is written before the development of quantum mechanics, so he's not talking about the doubts about the law of causality raised by quantum mechanics. He's talking about other doubts that have already been raised. All of these doubts are epistemologically permissible and quite understandable in view of the existing profound difficulties. After all, these are his doubts he's talking about. Before we seriously consider such extreme possibilities, however, we have to test whether one must conclude from the previous facts and arguments that it is really impossible to succeed with partial differential equations. In other words, I'm going to carry through the idea of unified field theory to the end using the idea of partial differential equations and continuum, but I recognize perfectly well there's a logical case to be made against the whole endeavor. The two sides of the two Einsteins come out quite clearly in this quotation. Well, the next quotation I found was in a letter to an old friend of his, Paul Langevin. He could see them in 1923. They were both pacifists, and this is a pacifist rally in Berlin, which Langevin, a Frenchman, attended. And here's Langevin at a later time, around 1935, when Einstein wrote to his old friend. One does not have the right today to maintain that the foundation of physics must consist of a field theory in the sense of Maxwell. The other possibility leads, in my opinion, to a renunciation of the space-time continuum and to a purely algebraic physics. That's the first time I found him to use that phrase. I'm not saying it's the first time he used it, it's the first time I was able to find it. You see, we hark back that use of algebraic, which may go back to Dedekind, but may not. But algebraic seemed to him to have meant combinatorial, because after all, there are continuous algebras too. Lie algebras involve continuity, but for algebraic, for Einstein, seemed to have always meant something involving discreteness. Continuing the letter, logically, this is quite possible. The system is described by a number of integers. Time is only a possible viewpoint from which the other observables can be considered, an observable logically coordinated to all the others. Such a theory doesn't have to be based upon the probability concept. here he's making an oblique criticism of quantum mechanics. By 1935, quantum mechanics was in its heyday, and he didn't like theories based on probability concepts, so this appealed to him that such a theory, discrete theory, wouldn't have to be based on probability concept. For the present, however, instinct rebels against such a theory. Although he recognizes the possibility, he's still going on with the unified field theory, the other alternative. But you see, he's quite candid about the logical possibility of the other Einsteins' point of view. By 36, he's back in print again in a very long and interesting article, which sort of sums up his whole approach to physics from a, well, you might say philosophical point of view, but I like to take the definition of philosophy that Peter Bergman gave. A theoretical physicist is a philosopher in working clothes. Or as I like to put it, philosophy is too important to us, theoretical physics, to leave it to the philosophers. So he writes in this paper, interesting in many ways, but he alludes to this question. In view of the molecular structure of all events in the small, the introduction of a space-time continuum may be considered contrary to nature. Perhaps the success of matrix mechanics, he uses another phrase, but I'm summarizing here, points to a purely algebraical method of description of nature. Again, algebra, matrices, is closer to the concept of discreteness in algebra. Through the elimination of continuous functions from physics. Then, however, we must also give up, on principle, the utilization of the space-time continuum. It is not impossible that human ingenuity will someday find methods that will make it possible to proceed along this path. Meanwhile, however, this project resembles the attempt to breathe in an airless space. In other words, I have no idea, and I don't think anybody else has an idea, what mathematics to use. Well, today the situation is changing in this respect, but it certainly is a problem. What mathematics do you use if you want to describe a discretum in a way that's useful in physics? Now, a few more quotes from the end of his life. Remember, he died in 55. To his old friend, his oldest friend, Michele Besso, he wrote in 1954, I consider it, here they are, as old men together, I consider it entirely possible that physics cannot be based upon the field concept, that is, on continuous structures. Then nothing will remain of my whole castle in the air, including the theory of gravitation, but also nothing of the rest of contemporary physics. If I go down, everything goes down. Samson. To David Bohm, and I have a picture of the young David Bohm, who was a colleague at Princeton. Einstein was the Institute, Bohm was in the physics department, but they both were in Princeton and they knew each other. Bohm got into a great deal of trouble with the House Un-American Activities Committee, ultimately was forced to resign from the Princeton Physics Department and left the country, never to work again in the United States, although he was allowed to visit in his later years. But Einstein was very sympathetic to him for political reasons and less sympathetic with Bohm's ideas about hidden variables. That's, again, a misunderstanding. Some people say Einstein advocated hidden variable views. I don't think that's correct. But he does say to Bohm in a letter, I must confess that I was not able to find a way to explain the atomistic character of nature. My opinion is that if the objective description through the field as an elementary concept is not possible, then one has to find a possibility to avoid the continuum altogether, altogether, but in parentheses, together with space and time. But I have not the slightest idea what kind of elementary concepts could be used in such a theory. He's coming back to this point. Great idea. I have no idea of how to do it. And that's why he confined himself mostly to private letters, because he didn't think he should just rave on and on. Well, this letter tells you this point. The most detailed discussion he had of these ideas was in this letter to Joachim. The alternative continuum, discontinuum, seems to me to be a real alternative. That is, there is here no compromise. Physics up to now is naturally, in essence, a continuum physics, in spite of the use of the material point, which looks like a discontinuous conceptual element and has no more right of existence in a field description. Again, dualism. I don't like that. You've got to get rid of particles if you're really going to have a field theory, field description. Its strength lies in, that is the field concept. Its strength lies in the fact that it posits parts that exist quasi-independently beside one another. You have the field here and the field there, and you can experiment in each part separately. Upon this rests the fact that there are reasonable laws, that is, rules which can be formulated and tested for individual parts. This separability was very important to Einstein. Indeed, that was the main problem he had with quantum mechanics. Quantum entanglement seemed to mean that two regions of space-time were not separable completely, but that's another issue. Its weakness, that is the continuum concept, lies in the fact that it has not been possible up to now to see how that atomistic aspect, including quantum relations, can result as a consequence. An algebraic theory of physics, the other side of the story, is affected with just the inverted advantages and weaknesses. aside from the fact that no one has been able to propose a possible logical schema for such a theory. Nobody's done it. It would be especially difficult to derive something like a spatiotemporal quasi-order from such a scheme. And this is, again, one of the problems that faces anyone trying to do this today. How do you derive the spatiotemporal order, which everyday life is built upon, and most of physics uses, from a discrete scheme? I cannot imagine how the axiomatic framework of such a physics would appear, and I don't like it when one talks about it in dark apostrophes. But I hold it entirely possible that the development will lead there. For it seems that the state of any finite spatially limited system may be fully characterized by a finite number of numbers. Well, here are Einstein's last words on the subject, indeed his last published words on physics. They occur in the final words of the Appendix 2 to the fifth edition of this little book, The Meaning of Relativity, which was actually published posthumously. One can give good reasons why, and these are the last words of that final appendix, so his final words to the world, as it turned out. On physics. One can give good reasons why reality cannot at all be represented by a continuous field. From the quantum phenomena, it appears to follow with certainty that a finite system of finite energy can be completely described by a finite set of numbers, quantum numbers. This does not seem to be in accordance with the continuum theory and must lead on to an attempt to find a purely algebraic theory for the description of reality. But nobody knows how to obtain the basis of such a theory. So he's now made these private doubts quite public, and essentially summarize what he'd been saying in private letters for the last few years. Where do we stand today? The search for a theory of quantum gravity has led many physicists to search for ways to go beyond the continuum. Indeed, by setting a limit to how much energy can be crammed into a given volume before a black hole is formed, general relativity seems to set a lower limit to the validity of the concept of space-time region. And here's a quote from Thomas Thiemann, who summarized this point very nicely. He's one of the leading research workers on the loop quantum gravity. His book on quantum gravity is impressed by him. The concept of a smooth space-time should not have any meaning in a quantum theory of the gravitational field. We are probing distances beyond the Planck length. We'll come back to what the Planck length means in just a moment. Probing distances beyond the Planck length must result in black hole creation, which then evaporates in Planck time. That is, space-time should be fundamentally discrete. He's saying it's because of the uncertainty principle. If you try to cram too much energy by probing in very small distances, I suggested at the beginning, you cram a lot of energy into a small space, it's going to form a black hole, and that region of space-time will just disappear. So the very concept of continuous space-time breaks down when you try to cram too much energy into too small a region of space for too short a period of time. Well, so here's my little excursus on Planck units. Are these the key to the problem? A lot of people think they are. You can make a length, a time unit, an energy unit, a mass unit, and a temperature unit out of three fundamental constants. Planck's constant, quantum theory, the gravitational constant, Newton's gravitational constant from gravity theory, and velocity of light from relativity theory, if you like, special relativity theory. And that's the definition of the Planck length. All the others you form very simply from that. The Planck length is 10 to the minus 33rd centimeters, not exactly a big distance. The Planck time is 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, roughly the time light travels Planck length. So these are the scales we're talking about. And these are the scales where, at least from dimensional considerations, we might expect the concept of continuous space-time to break down. Remember, we said if you probe more and more, you might reach a point where, just like the grains of sand or the water, if you look closely enough, the continuum, parent continuum breaks down. Well, this would be the dimensional argument that it's going to be at the Planck length and the Planck time where we'll notice this discontinuity, assuming it exists. Well, then, continuing the quote from Thiemann, but clearly smooth diffeomorphisms, with the way we treat changes in the spatial and temporal coordinates, have no room in such a discrete space-time. The fundamental symmetry, which is diffeomorphism symmetry in general relativity, is probably something else, maybe a combinatorial one, that looks like a diffeomorphism, like continuous deformation at large scales. And Faye Delker has made another a woman who worked primarily on the causal set approach to quantum gravity has remarked that most physicists believe that in any final theory of quantum gravity, space-time itself will be quantized and grainy in nature. So the smallest possible volume in four-dimensional space-time, notice volume in the four-dimensional sense, is 10 to the minus 42nd cubic centimeter seconds. So you take the Planck length and cube it and multiply it by the Planck time to get a volume in space-time. And that's what she's talking about. So that's the place where you would expect the concept of smooth space-time to break down, by, at least by these dimensional arguments. And Raphael Sorkin has advocated an approach to quantum gravity based on the idea of constructing a quantum theory of causal sets based on two features of classical general relativity that he takes as fundamental: the causal structure, that space-time causal structure, which Einstein mentioned as such a problem, which is replaced by a discrete causal set. So from the very beginning, the causal set, people postulate there exists a causal set, and the four-dimensional volume element, which is replaced by the quantum of process. That's what Faye Dacre was talking about in that last quotation. That 10 to the 42nd cubic centimeter seconds. So instead of points, it would have elements of process, because something occupying space and time is a process, not a point of space, but process. That's why I think about a quantum of process. Now, Lee Smolin and Carlo Rovelli have introduced quanta of volume and area in the loop quantum gravity approach. And we have a real problem here, whether one should be looking for quanta of space or quanta of space-time. Seems to be one of the essential points of difference between the canonical loop quantum gravity approach, which Rovelli and Smolin have used, and the covariant causal set approach, which Dacre and Sorkin have advocated. This is obviously a question which we're not going to settle here. It's a question for the future. To my great surprise, I came across a quotation from Louis Crane, an outstanding mathematician who's been working on the problems of quantum gravity. And he wrote a paper, actually it's 10 years ago, this paper appeared, but he's continued to work on these problems and has done some remarkable work quite recently. He wrote a paper called Clock and Category: Is Quantum Gravity Algebraic? And he says in that paper, to my great surprise, I recently learned from an essay by John Stachel, that's the one I cited earlier, that the ideas explored here are very similar to the ones that Einstein was exploring near the end of his career. Apparently, these ideas remained obscure because Einstein did not have the mathematical tools to carry them to fruition and discussed them only orally or in letters. I was able to resist the urge to retitle this paper on some ideas of Professor Einstein, but given the unconventional nature of my proposal, I am happy for the moral support. Einstein, after all, was often ahead of his time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John, for a very informative and extremely clear talk. We now have some time for questions. If you have a question, please put up your hand and one of our roving microphone people will come to you. Are there any questions? There's a question for a gentleman in the red jacket there.
I wonder if some of the language you were talking about that maybe Einstein was missing would have to do with ideas of entropy and information theory that we seem to have these days, and if you think that they could have been recast in those terms.
The language missing for
example, like the fact that it goes even back to Hume, that there's just too much information in the universe for, mm-hmm. and if you sort of took some of the ideas about a black hole sets, for example, a limit on the amount of information that can be in a space, and therefore how much description could you do of that space? You know?
In fact, one of my teachers, David Finkelstein, said the universe should be compared to a giant computer, which would clearly mean that would have to have to deal with bits of information which are discrete entities. So that's certainly one possible path to take. Yes, I would agree with that. That's one possible path, not the only possible path, but certainly a possible path to treat the universe as a giant computer and have the discreteness come from discreteness of the bits of information.
Are there any other questions? In the audience?
Have I solved all problems or left people completely flabbergasted?
there.
In some ways, a young lady behind there.
There's a question from the lady in the third row. And then.
Complete novice's point of view, I don't know if this question will even make sense, but I would like to know, what are the implications of having a continuous theory versus a discrete one? What would be the implication of this new way of conceptualizing things? the overall implication? How would it change our way of thinking?
It would certainly revolutionize our theoretical point of view, right? If it turned out that the continuum, which has been used for what, the last 3,000 years as our basic tool in most of science, that this concept was eliminable, that you could eliminate it, and we could do successful theoretical work without using this concept. By the way, this was very close to Boltzmann's point of view. Boltzmann felt that we're always averaging things, and the things that we treat as continuous are all basically discrete things which we have to average. But of course, he was living on the basis of a continuous background of space and time. So if the space and time themselves become discrete, that would be certainly a remarkable theoretical achievement. What practical implications it would have would be hard to say at this point, because we're so far from reaching it. The experiments we do today are so many orders of magnitude from 10 to the 43rd, 10 to the minus 33rd, 10 to the minus 43rd for space and time, respectively, that we have no way of knowing. What were the implications of a molecular point of view? Suppose you'd asked Lucretius that in whatever century he lived in, B.C. He was a firm advocate of the molecular point of view. He had some good arguments for it, like the fact that when people constantly step on the same stone, it wears away, even though you can't notice it. Over many, many years, the stone wears away. Well, how can you explain that without a molecular conception? But if you ask him what the practical implications were, he would have been very hard put. I think we're about in the position of Lucretius on this question. It certainly would have practical implications, but until we have a viable quantum theory of gravity and talk about how to apply it, it's hard to say what those practical applications would be. But it would probably be as great as the transition from continuous to discrete in the atomic molecular point of view. It certainly revolutionized many, many conceptual and practical things. And I think a quantum theory of gravity, which was based on a discretum fundamentally, would, again, have many very revolutionary implications if we can't foresee at this point.
There's a question.
That's the answer I can give you. I can only wish you should live so long to see the answer. I couldn't wish you better.
Question right here.
Professor Satchel, I'm Gord Rice. Is all of this information in that book that you were promoting?
Those quotations?
Yeah, quotations, everything we've heard today.
Well, not everything. Some of the attempts to make things like what is a variable and what is a continuum, those I've just added because I was trying to follow the behest of Einstein. Everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler.
It just thrilled me to hear that Einstein was there so many years ago because, it's...
All the quotations from Einstein are in the paper in my
book. Got to get the book.
Yeah. I'm not going to argue with you.
If you were really flogging the book well, John, you should have had the ISBN number and the price from Amazon and all that. But go to Amazon. There's a question right up at the top by somebody right by the aisle there.
Hi, I'm Stan Burris. I remember one of my friends in high school telling me about a work of Eddington, mm-hmm. that he had done some calculations about the total number of particles of some sort in the universe. Mm-hmm. I know nothing about that. Perhaps you could say a few words about Eddington's point of view on the cosmology.
Well, of course, Eddington's point of view was based on the continuum point of view, so it had nothing to do with this. It would have maybe had a discrete number of particles, but in a continuous cosmological model. I think Eddington's theory was, well, you know what Bohr said about somebody's theory, it was crazy, but not crazy enough. there were some suspicious things about it, too, but Eddington based his viewpoint on a certain value of the fine structure constant, which he thought he had computed from his theory. Then when it turned out that the actual value of the fine structure constant was one unit different, he gave a theoretical explanation why it had this new value. This always makes you suspicious when people fudge, you know. You know what Eugene Wigner, the famous theoretical physicist, said about having parameters in a theory. You give me a number, I'll draw you an elephant. Give me two numbers, I'll make his tail wiggle. So we're always very suspicious of theories that have free parameters.
That seems like a very good point to sum up. At this point, I'd like to thank Professor Satchel once more for a very informative talk. Thank you.
Thank you.